Good evening, and welcome to the second part of Venerable Rubina's teaching on self-compassion, forgiveness, and purification. I'm really glad to see you all here. I'm Donna. I'm a co-spiritual programs coordinator at the Kadampa Center, and I have a couple of short announcements. Some of you have heard these all week long, and just bear with me. Just want to tell you a little bit about Venerable Rubina. She is, she has been a Buddhist for about 40 years. She's been a nun for a little bit more than 35. A student of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who is the spiritual director of our parent organization. She has a very direct, penetrating, sharp, illuminating, and sometimes terrifying style of teaching. But she has really wonderful insights, and she challenges us to challenge ourselves, so it's very helpful. A couple of things I want to alert you to. There are opportunities to travel with Venerable Rubina in Asia later this year, and then you can get teachings from her all day, every day. She will be leading a retreat at Borobudur, that is a 9th century Buddhist temple in Indonesia. And she will also be leading a pilgrimage in India and Nepal. It lasts about 3 or 4 weeks. You go to really amazing Buddhist holy sites, places that were milestones in Shakyamuni Buddha's life, Lumbini, his birthplace, Shravasti, where he and his disciples were in retreat for 3 months of the year during the rainy season, Kushinagar, where he passed, Rajgir, where he gave the teaching on emptiness, and Bodh Gaya, where he became enlightened. So it's really quite amazing, and it's a life-changing experience. And several of us in this room, including myself, have been there. Nikki has been on that retreat. Louise has. John, I saw you a moment ago. Oh, okay. Patrick? Well, yeah, so if you were interested, you can speak to any of us. Also, there are postcards out in the lobby right across from the bookstore where if you're interested, you can take a postcard and send an email to Effie, who organizes these, and she'll let you know all you need to know. Starting tomorrow, Venerable Rubina will be teaching a 3-day workshop on how to enjoy death. It's based in part on this book, which is available in the bookstore. Thank you for lending me yours. Okay. For those of you who are not familiar with Kadampa Center or some of the little traditions, when the teacher enters the room, we stand out of respect for the teacher and the teachings that she holds. If you do come to Kadampa Center regularly, then you will be accustomed to when our Geshe Gelug prostrates to the altar, he requests that we prostrate with him, but that's not traditional. So when Venerable Rubina prostrates, we will wait, and then after she takes her seat, those of us who wish to will prostrate, and if prostration is unfamiliar, uncomfortable for you, there's no need to do it. Thank you, Scott. She will stop teaching and open the floor to questions. Please, we are recording this and streaming it online for people, so please use the microphone and remember, some of us are very expressive when we speak, but if you're expressive like this, you can't be heard. So keep the microphone close to your face if you can. We will appreciate it. Don't forget to mute your phones. Also, we will be tomorrow at noon, actually, we will be doing a puja here. And when we do puja, we change the setup of the room a little bit. So if you're able to stay for a few minutes tonight after the teachings, we'll be doing that. Susie can help you a little bit with what needs to be done. The nuns will be able to tell us, and I'll kind of be running back and forth a little bit, but I can help too. And last, everything that we offer at Kadampa Center, if it's Dharma, if it's the teachings, it's always been our tradition that we do this at no charge. These teachings we feel are so precious that we never want money to be an obstacle to anybody hearing them. Of course, it does cost us money to make the teachings available. So, if when you've heard Venerable Robina, you are moved, you feel like she's changing your life, and you would like to support having her here, we would greatly appreciate any donations that you are moved to give from your heart. There is a donation box right outside the door. There's one right inside the center, and she's here.
Are we on?
No. Yes, we are. Okie doke. Okay. I see everybody. No, hidden people everywhere. Oh dear. You ought to have bleachers, isn't it, really? It's the only way to be.
Well,
I know, really. Or I should levitate. But I'm afraid I can't. I'm sorry. Okay. Everybody, thank you. All right.
Okay.
Do a few little holy things. Relax, sit, listen to the whatever, or join in as you wish.
Let's see. In the Gold Prayer Book, if you please turn to page 27, we'll read the Seven Limb Prayer, page 27. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of Sattva's existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Let's turn to page 97 in the same book. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I offer this as a Buddha field, and may all living beings enjoy this pure land. O holy and perfect pure Lama, from the clouds of compassion that form in the skies of your Dharmakaya wisdom, please release a rain of vast and profound Dharma, precisely in accordance with the needs of those to be trained. Hidam Guru Ratha Mandalaka Niryatayami.
Okay, so now we can think that we're going to listen to these. We're going to, those of us who are Buddhist already or think of Buddha, reminding us of our reliance on the Buddha, the first two lines of this prayer. And the second two lines of the prayer are like stating kind of like an altruistic purpose or goal for our being here together tonight, to listen to these ideas, Buddha's views about these things, and to see if there's some tools we can take from it all to help us develop our own amazing potential, so that in turn we can help others. Yeah. Okay.
Sangye charam toke chong nam la jang chu baru dag ni kyab su chi dagi chon yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen che sangye dro pa shog sangye charam toke chong nam la jang chu baru dag ni kyab su chi dagi chon yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen che sangye dro pa shog sangye charam toke Ni kyab su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen che sangye dro pa shog.
Oh, thank you. There we go. Thank you, Dom. No, that's good. Stick them down there. Keep them down there. There we go. Excuse me, people.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we're going to carry on from yesterday. And what we're talking about is basically how we kind of reprogram our minds, really, is what we're honestly what we're saying. You know, we're talking about the mind and how it works, and we're talking about karma, this law of karma that for Buddha is a natural law. He's not made it up. He's not a creator. He's not speculating. He didn't have a vision of it. It wasn't revealed to him. He's observed it like a good scientist. You know, this is the approach in Buddhism. So if you're, you know, because it's something hard to prove immediately, it's highly advanced. You need a really subtle mind to be able to see the truth of this. Then we obviously, if we're trying to be a Buddhist, we're, you know, this is what I keep saying, and this is really the words I use for myself seriously, by taking Buddhism as my working hypothesis, you know. So the working hypothesis here is that every millisecond of whatever we experience, whatever we think, whatever we feel, whatever happens to us, is the fruit of past actions of mine, planted as seeds in my mind, in this mental continuum, as they call it, in this river of mental moments that goes back and back and back. It's the fruit of what I did before. Whatever I experience now is the fruit of what I put into my mind before, and whatever I do now will produce the fruits of my future. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, it's like self-creation. It's a way of saying it, you know, which is pretty shocking to us, because we're used to the view that you're the product of a creator, or you're the handiwork of your mummy and daddy. They're the options on the earth, you know, pretty much. But this is Buddha's view. So the consequence of this, the implication of this, is that you're the boss, you're in charge, and the implication is that, therefore, how marvellous, you can change things. And from the Buddhist point of view, there's not a single atom of anything we can't change in our mind, you know. So one way that karma ripens, as we've been discussing, is it ripens as a bunch of habits. And this is the killer. This is the one that destroys us. This is the one that gets us depressed. This is the one that makes us feel hopeless. And this is the one that makes us feel, I'm a bad person, you know. Because whatever the tendencies are, and these have been since we're tiny kids, Buddha says we came programmed with our own tendencies at the first, second of conception from having done them before. So you're nothing to do with your parents. They didn't make you the way you are, you know. They're your own tendencies. And so because they're such deep tendencies, many of the things we do, thank goodness, including the good, then we tend to say, oh, well, that's just who I am. I'm an angry person. I'm a jealous person. I'm a killing an ant person. You know, I'm a rapist person. I'm a murderer person. Because these tendencies seem to be there, and almost in spite of ourselves, we seem to want to do these things. We don't know why, you know. This is how it feels. I mean, many of my friends in prison, I remember one fellow, basically he was addicted to stealing. It's a simple way of putting it. You know, he had the habit to steal. He didn't need to steal. And he said one time, I watched myself, Abina, I watched myself go into this house, and he said, I didn't want to steal. I watched myself take this television. I didn't want a television. So, of course, in our culture, we go, yeah, 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 who are you trying to kid? You know? But this is how strong karma is. Now, look at our pathetic habits when you want to have the fourth piece of cake. You know? Just a little pathetic habit like eating too much food. It's almost like part of you is saying, I don't want to eat the cake, while your hand's going out and you're stuffing it in the mouth. And you're watching in astonishment, you know? This is how habits are. We all know this. Isn't it? I mean, even you think about people's really... So, you know, like I said, our habits are pretty pathetic. Eating too much food, being lazy, saying maybe vaguely wrong things. You know, habits. We don't even think that we intend to do them. We're just programmed. That's one powerful way that karma works. Because everything you think and do and say, it increases the potential within you to be better at doing and saying it. It's really clear. Now, you know, what's fascinating about this? We know this. We call it learning. If you sit there and start playing music, learning music, what are you doing? You're developing the habit to play music to the point where you just put your hands on the piano and the notes, you know, the fingers whiz up and down. Well, that's called learning. You have to make the effort. Before that, you didn't know where to put the fingers, but you learned it. It's called a habit. Well, we come into this life with certain habits really developed. You know, we can see that. And they're the ones, the negative ones, and they're the ones that really depress us. The good ones too, but we take them for granted. We don't even notice that we might be naturally moral, naturally don't want to lie, naturally don't want to kill some people, you know. Amazing. How marvelous. We should be in tears of happiness. So we understand that this is one way that karma ripens, as tendencies, as habits. So we'll have more humility with ourselves. We'll be more kind to ourselves instead of abusing ourselves because you tried to change once and it didn't work, you know. It's like thinking that you hop on the bicycle when you're 4 years old because someone says you can ride a bike. You hop on the bike, you get on one side, you fall off the other side. And then you want to kill yourself. Mummy, I tried to ride a bike and I couldn't do it. Well, honey, keep trying. Same here, you know. So like I was saying yesterday, in the very first stages of practice, like the foundation of one's practice, this is the basis upon which you build a good practice, is these first stages of like junior school entry level into Buddhism, is learning to understand karma, theoretically, how the laws of karma work, these natural laws, how we're the product of our own past intentional actions, which is the meaning of karma, that ripen in four ways. The type of rebirth, and in our case, a human birth. We should be crying in happiness every day at that alone. Of course, this doesn't occur to us because we assume, well, you know, someone else made me. I'm someone else's handiwork. I didn't ask to get born, did I? It's not my fault, we'll say. Well, Buddha says the opposite. You know, from the Buddhist perspective, we realized how hard we must have worked at past life in morality, conscious, intentional, refraining from killing, refraining from lying, refraining from stealing, consciously, actively helping others, benefiting others. In the context of a spiritual path, and not just that, as Lama Zopa says, the result of the life that we have now, including our humanity, and including, crucially, this access to our wish to practice a spiritual path, which is what makes us come to places like this. This is a fruit of phenomenal hard work. Not just in the context of being a good human in the past. Being good is not enough, Lama Zopa says. Not just even in the context of practicing a spiritual path, but in the context of keeping vows of morality. What we're experiencing is the fruit of that. It would blow our minds if we realize how hard we must have worked in the past just to be this human being with these few reasonable conditions that we've got. In particular, internally, the wish to continue to practice a spiritual path, to practice morality, to be a better person. This is amazing if we look at the suffering of this earth. To be born with a tendency to kill. And never to think of it as negative. To be born with a tendency to do all the things that so many human beings do. And how fortunate we don't have that tendency. And it's not just good luck. It's the result of our own hard work. So it takes time to think this because we tend to just feel like, well, this is who I am, you know. Take ourselves for granted. No, the more we think about karma, if we use that view in our lives, the more this should blow our minds, you know. So it should be humbling for us. So the first level of applying the laws of karma is to consciously, intentionally refrain from harming sentient beings. Two things here. First, because that's the definition of a negative action. The worst negative actions are ones that harm others. But then we get to really understand the reason behind Buddha's exhortation for us to not kill isn't because he says so, number one, and number two, isn't even because it harms others. It's because, guess what, honey, he says, it's going to harm you, Ravina. Because I intend to do it. I intend to do negative action, motivated by a delusion. This is what will sow seeds in my mind that will ripen in the future as my own suffering rebirth, as a tendency to keep doing it, as an experience similar to it, and as an environmental result of it. And this really, really does take time, you know, to really take on board mentally, to bring this sense of responsibility for ourselves, you know. So that's the very first level of applying the laws of karma. Then the powerful way to do that is to do it in the context of vows. So I didn't discuss that yesterday, but let's discuss that here in a second. But then the other approach, the one we're discussing, is the so-called, as they call it, the practice of purification. It's just a term they use in Tibetan Buddhism. But what it is the process of taking responsibility for the seeds we've already planted, the Buddha would say, in countless lives, that we're lugging around with us, because there's no seed that goes astray. There are trillions of seeds on our mind stream. I like to think of them, all these bank vaults of seeds we're lugging around with us from life to life. There's no way, when we understand karma, that I would want those negative seeds to ripen as my suffering, because guess what? I'm sick of suffering. So not only is it's not enough, the most urgent level of practice, as Rinpoche says, is to watch your body and speech, and at least not harm others, and at least refrain from sowing more negative seeds. And then the other one is then to take care of the negative seeds we've already planted, and do everything we can to prevent them from ripening as my suffering. As long as Rinpoche says, this practice that we began to discuss yesterday, which we can go into more detail today, and maybe I'll lead you through it, called the Four Opponent Powers, this process of purification, it's a psychological process, you know, the more we understand it. Don't think of it as religious, it's practical. We're insane, Rinpoche says, not to do this practice every day. So it's like, if we get the idea, I like the analogy, you know, the lamas a lot use the analogy of seeds and fruits. It's a really good one to get our heads around this idea of karma. So one way I like to say is that if we think of our life, my humanity, my tendencies, what happens to me at the hands of others, and even the way the physical world impacts upon me, well, this is, my life is my garden. And I grew it. I created it. I made it. I am right now experiencing the fruits of my past hard gardening, good and bad, the weeds and the flowers. As Lama Zopa says, everything that we experience in this life, the way he puts it is, it's our karmic appearance. The Buddha's view is karma is a natural law. This is really hard to hear. That whoever we meet, no accident, can't be random. If it's a natural law, it necessarily, events can't be random. People you meet can't be random. The sentient beings, what they do to you, can't be random. In other words, whatever's in a garden, we know is there as a result, you know, within the law of cause and effect called botany. You'd no way you'd say, well, most plants come from seeds, but some are just accidents. I mean, people would laugh you out of botany school. This is consistent every time. It's coherent. This is the law of karma. This is shocking to us. We don't think like this, you know. Because we think of it as punishment and reward. Not like that. There's no punisher. There's no rewarder for Buddha. We're experiencing the fruits of our own stuff. So then everything that occurs in our life, all the good and all the bad, they're the fruits of my actions. It's such a powerful concept, you know. And when we begin to get our head around it, it brings such energy, such enthusiasm, such confidence, such accountability, such grown up, you know. We become grown up and brave, therefore, in the face of the rubbish that happens, because we know it's our own rubbish, you know. You don't feel like a victim. It's very powerful. It takes time to think about it. Because instinctively, we believe the opposite. It's all just not fair. It's all just random. No one knows. It just happens, you know. I mean, no wonder we have fear thinking like that. That's an appalling philosophy. So, before we do the purification practice and talk more in depth about it, let's look at this business of how the first level of karma, refraining from harming, controlling our body and speech. It's called the level of the morality of restraint. The very first level, ground level, foundation level, entry level into Buddhism. And the foundation of all the development of our practice to the most sophisticated levels. Based upon this one. So this understand. Are there any chairs? Or you just like standing?
Well, I myself enjoy standing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
but you're very welcome. Yeah, you're very welcome. You can stand up, you can stand on your head, you can walk around, I don't mind. Be comfortable. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Okay, so
We know the word vow. When you get married, you take a vow, you know? And we tend to think of it, like always, as something kind of restrictive. We might choose to do it, or we make a vow, we'll go on a diet. And we know vows are kind of tasty. And of course, if you choose it, it's a wonderful thing, because it reminds you every day. It's sort of like a determination, a really strong determination, you've got to do something. And we know it works, it's very practical. Well, that's the same in the Buddhist view. Exactly the same. It's a practical tool. When you're really determined to do something, or indeed not to do something, that's what really what a vow is. So, well, a vow, strictly speaking, in the Buddhist view, is a determination to refrain from something. I mean, we know it's true. I remember years and years ago when I was doing kung fu, and I was really fit, right? I was fit. I had less fat on the body, and I felt fit, you know. Then I gave up kung fu. What do you think? What happens? You get fat again. I get fat, you know. So then I'd go, oh, you know, I should go on a diet. And yet 27 years later, I'm still saying, well, I should go on a diet. You know, until you say, I will go on a diet, we all know you won't go on a diet. It's got to be, I will. So one day, indeed, this is years ago, I decided to go on a diet. And then, of course, I lost weight. I have a very special diet. It's called eating less. Yes, for me it's the only one. Forget all the exercise, it's too exhausting, you know. Just eat less. And I have very slow metabolism, and I have to eat 500 calories a day. It's very depressing, isn't it? 500 calories is like starvation diet for most people. It keeps me fat. Anyway, never mind. A vow. We understand the meaning, you know, we understand it. When two people get married, it's got great meaning. You stand in front of each other, you read a little thing together, you do kind of do a deal, you do with witnesses, you know. You've got it in the back of your head all the time. It's obvious, it's powerful. Well, the Buddha's view, it's really quite interesting how they describe it. It's really got logic to it if we understand this process, the way they talk about how karma is created. I remember one time Lama Zopa said, you could have one person who does bucket loads of practice every day, lots of spiritual practice. And then another person who merely just keeps their vow, let's say, not to kill, purely. And doesn't do much else. He says the second person is doing far more benefit to their mind, creating lots of virtuous imprints in the mind, creating merit, as they call it, and purifying their minds because of the power of a vow. It's said to be so stupendous, you know. The Buddha loves his vows. So it's like this. This is the logic of it. So here we are in this room at this moment, and probably if we look around, we're noticing that we're not killing any sentient beings. I don't notice any rats or roaches or terrorists or mosquitoes around, you know? So we're not actually killing anything. Well, that's great for the rats and the roaches. They're not being killed. But we are not creating any virtuous karma in our mind by merely not killing. Because we're not intending not to kill. So we said yesterday, and this takes us time to hear as well, that the real thing about karma, you almost could say the actual essential meaning of the idea of creating karma, it starts with the thought, intention. And like I said, if you're walking down the street, and $50 falls out of your pocket, and a lucky homeless person gets it, they've got their 50 bucks. You did not create the karma of generosity, but simply because you had no thought to give $50. It fell out of your pocket. You didn't give anybody $50. You're probably even thinking about keeping your $50 and how you don't want to give it to anybody. You didn't create the generosity of $50. Not at all, of course you didn't. And just the same, if you're standing there in the kitchen cooking the dinner, taking care of your babies or something, and there's no thought of killing, but by accident, you stand on an ant. There can't possibly be karma in your mind, because karma starts in your mind. It's a mental action. The word means action, but it begins with the mental action. Mental action. It's the meaning of karma. Intention. If the mind's not involved, you can't say there's karma. It's highly complex, the scenario, the situation. I mean, the whole workings of it all. But it begins in the mind. As Lama Zopa said, there's a nice saying in Tibetan. Everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought, I will, intention. I always say, too, it's like me walking out that door. It has to start with my thoughts. No matter how quick, I'll walk out the door. Believe me, I will not walk out that door until my thought says I'll walk out the door. You think about this, it's really logical. But we don't even notice our intentions because we're mostly programmed with trillions of them, you know. That's why we're always like as blind as bats because we don't see our minds. So, here we are being nice people in this room, not killing. But everyone, not unless we're thinking, I will not kill. And the only time we will think, I will not kill, is if there's a sentient being there we wish not to kill. Therefore, at this moment in time, if we don't have vows, that's what I'm about to say, we are creating zero karma of not killing. We're being nice people, but we're not getting any benefit from it. Because it's got to be the mind actively thinking, I will not kill. So, in other words, the only time we create the virtuous karmic imprint, leave a tendency, leave a programming, leave a seed in the mind, is when our mind thinks, I must not kill that ant. Then you pop a little seed in of the conscious, intentional, virtuous action of non-killing. But that's not very strong. Not strong enough. As someone always says, this is the power of vows. They say the power of vows. Buddha, like I said, he loves his vows. Vows are said to be so stupendous. Having sat in front of somebody whom you see as the Buddha for you, who has took those vows from a previous person, who, and you track it all the way back, like this power source is how I like to think of it, all the way back to Buddha himself, in this unbroken chain of human beings holding these vows. So you're kind of like plugging into that power source. You receive, like in this kind of little ceremony, receive that vow from somebody, and you kneel there and you say after that person, I will never kill. And from now until the day I die, I will never kill. Meaning intentionally. And every day you remember that vow, and you reiterate that decision, and then every day you also purify. Then this is like putting atomic bombs on the imprints of killing. So the 24 hours a day, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, which is what the teachings say, the Buddha says, 24 hours a day, while you're having sex with your new girlfriend, while you're in the pub having a beer, while you're sitting up watching television, eating popcorn, you're ticking over the virtuous karma of non-killing, and you're purifying your mind. It's the only reason I'm a nun. What do I want to look like a 14th century ball person for? I mean it. I really like that idea. Because I want to get ahead of the game. I want to put lots of imprints in my mind, get ahead of the game, so I've got a decent life next life and carry on bopping, you know, doing my trip. I really like the idea of vows. I'm a fan of vows, you know. Are we communicating here a little bit? I mean, it's a pretty intense concept, and it's pretty abstract unless we really think about it. I can't prove this is true, but sort of because it's mental, it's mental. Karma is done by the mind. It's not like some big stick someone's walking around about to beat you with, which is how we think of karma. It's ridiculous. It's just a word. It's shorthand. It's just colloquial. Karma is meaning referring to the law of cause and effect, particularly in relation to minds and what they do every second. Because every second any mind does anything, which is then often carried out by the servants of the mind, which is our body and speech, this is what programs our mind. It's called learning. It's called developing habits, you know. First one, main one. So living in vows, making you having this, which is so stupendous again, to actually wish to be a good person, to want to live a life of non-harming others. It's so outrageous. I mean, I'm really not kidding when I say we're like the 0.1%, not the rich, the fortunate. I'm not being arrogant. I'm not even saying you have to be a Buddhist. I don't care about that. This is a mental thing. The thought not to want to harm, and then wanting to live your life, to define yourself in terms of being a non-harmer, a non-killer, a non-thief, a non-liar, a non, you know, offender of other sentient beings. Just vowing this way and remembering it every day, reiterating it every day, and purifying the imprints. This is the most powerful practice. You can be relaxed in the rest of your life and do little more than this. Except watch your body, speech, and mind, and reiterate these vows and purify every day. You have an amazing practice. Do not think you don't. It's incredible. It's just the same in the opposite way. You know, for example, you might have a tendency to kill sometimes. Or you kill an ant, kill it, you know. But most of the time you're not thinking about it. But let's just say you have a strong karmic imprint from the past. I always think of this example, which I've been telling you for 20 years. So, again, I'm sorry I bore you. There's this particular story. A woman I met in Koppan years ago, she came to my room crying. She'd heard Lama Zopa teach about karma. And she had her boy who died 25 years before. He was 29. She said he'd spent his life as a professional fisherman. You know, not being rude about fishermen, but obviously that means killing sentient beings. Well, since he was like 5, when he first met fishing, it's like he fell in love with fishing. Meaning he had a karmic tendency to kill. He brought that with him from the past because he hadn't purified it. He had a tendency to keep killing. He meets a scenario called fishing. It's like he recognizes it. He doesn't think of it like that, of course. And then, of course, because attachment rises instantaneously, and that makes the fishing look delicious. And then also because the attachment triggers a very tasty feeling in his body, so the natural deduction is, oh, wow, fishing must be great because I'm feeling good. So then, of course, he wants to go fishing. In other words, it's like he took a vow to kill. He defined himself as a fisherman. All his choices in life were in relation to his being a fisherman. All his choice, when he got up, when he went to bed, the food he ate, when he went out, what he did, the things he bought, everything was in reference to his definition of himself as a fish killer. I'm not being mean here, just talking. So it was like he'd taken a vow to kill. That's obviously heavier than if you kill occasionally. Just the same as having a vow not to kill. That's more powerful than just consciously not killing occasionally. It's logical. It has more potency, you know. Because even when he wasn't consciously killing, everything was his choices was in reference to when he'd go out and kill more fish. The things he bought, what the weather was like. Everything was in reference to that. That was entire identity. It was like he was in love with fishing. He even called himself Salmon. Sal for short. And this is a tragedy about attachment. What attachment does, it makes a wonderful story about the person, the cake, the fishing, whatever. It makes it look delicious, which of course what makes us want to keep doing it. So, when you define yourself in this way, it's heavier for the good as well, defining yourself as a non-harmer, and that's what taking vows means. So it's an easy thing to do, and if we appreciate this idea of wanting to turn yourself into a nice person, because don't think, it's not just you doing it for the sake of the ants and the dogs and the fish. No, we've got to get the point that what motivates us in the beginning is the wish to not create more harmful habits that will harm me. It's got to be for our own sake. It's got to be compassion for ourselves. It's not just, oh, I'm being a nice person. Look at me. I don't kill. No. You've got to realize it's for your benefit. This, I keep saying, takes time. Like eating good food. We all know it means it's going to benefit me. No one has to teach us that. Well, the same here. Acting nicely, being nice, not harming others benefits you. It turns you into the person you want to become. Now, forget about the future. So it's got such power. It should delight us, you know. Rather than feel like a vow, some kind of restriction. I'm not supposed to do this. I'll get punished if I do. Nothing to do with that. So that's a marvelous way to, you know, not kill, not lie, not steal, etc. Live in the vows. So tasty, so delicious. Got a cushion? There's one. Good. So then, of course, the next one is then to take care of all the seeds we've already planted to prevent them from ripening as further suffering. And this is this powerful practice. Called, in general, they call it purification. So even if you're not a Buddhist, you can hear this. It's logical, you know. It's logical. Like if you eat the wrong food and you know it's going to make you sick because you're attached to chocolate, the first thing you've got to do is regret that you did it. And that means, Rabina, you idiot, you just ate another piece of chocolate, it's going to make you fat, you told yourself you'd be on a diet. So you go, I regret that. For whose sake? My sake. So you regret, you've got to first acknowledge you did it. And then you think, well, you know, I've got to rely on my tools and my diet, you know, go to my Weight Watchers or something, rely on that to help me keep on track, you know. And then you do some little kind of thing to fix it, and then your fourth one is you vow to keep your vow. You vow, I won't eat more chocolate again. It's practical. It's practical. Don't think of it as religious. So here, it's these, you know, the first is to regret, like I said yesterday. And because we're all so caught up in all the drama of guilt and blame and shame, we've got to really be clear the meaning of regretting something. A common point that comes up here, I don't know if it's occurred to your mind, but let's say, you know, one thing often, when you do something, let's say, I mean, okay, when I was 23, I had an abortion, for example. Well, at the time, my mindset, the way I saw life, I never thought of it being anything so-called negative. I never even thought of it as being a human being. I knew all I could visualize was a baby in 9 months, and I didn't want that baby. That's all I could think of. Of course, I could say it was a self-centered thing to do. So I had an abortion. So, okay, at that age, at that time, how I was, there's no way I could have made another choice because my mind was like that. So then I remember many people saying to me, well, if I regret it, how can I say that? Because I couldn't have done something different. So it's not as if you've got to go back and change it. That's clearly absurd. But if, let's say, I've been, you know, let's say it's a simple action like smoking cigarettes. For, you know, since I was 15, smoking cigarettes. And then at some point, I decided to give up cigarettes. So that means I do regret. At that point, I did regret whatever I did back in the past out of my ignorance that is now going to probably cause me suffering in my poor little lungs. Well, not too bad, so I was very fortunate. So that regret means what a fool I was back when I was 15 and didn't realize what I was doing to myself. Now look at the consequences. Let's say I've got lung cancer. So regretting would mean, or if you've got a test, almost they say you might get lung cancer. So regret means you look in the past and you go, wow, I didn't realize. I just didn't realize. I was ignorant. I didn't know that smoking would harm me. That's what regret is. It's not saying you're a bad person, you shouldn't have done it, you can't change it. Of course you can't. You look at what you did do, which is now bringing consequences. And out of respect for yourself and compassion, I regret that foolishness then. I didn't realize what I was doing, how it would harm me. That's the meaning of regret. It's like kindness to yourself. Not this brutal beating yourself up. Not this absurd nonsense of I'm a bad person. This is meaningless. Useless. Impotent. Not helpful. And not accurate. It's an absurd exaggeration. So regret is a healthy attitude. It's acknowledging that I did kill, lie, stole, did this, did that, whatever. These actions that are considered negative, ones that harm others, but ones which leave imprints in my mind that will cause me that kind of suffering in the future, and which are, you know, the tendencies and all that business. So this, regret's a wholesome thing. It's taking responsibility. It's recognizing I did do it. And you know what? I regret that from the depths of my heart, because what I did when I did that, I left seeds in my mind, and they've been growing and growing and growing, and I want to kind of change this before they start to ripen, for my sake. Then I think, the next one, whom can I turn to? I turn to the Buddha. He's my doctor. So what's the basis of turning to a doctor? There's two things. One is, I've got to know I want either, what is it, either preventative or curative, isn't it? Either one of those. I've got to know I'm sick or don't want to be sick. Clear. You don't go to the doctor because you've got a cute nose. Well, you might if you want a boyfriend. But if you want a doctor, you've got to go because you want what the doctor's got. That's obvious. So you turn to the Buddha in exactly the same way. Not because someone says, not because you think it's a good idea. It's because you've thought about the Buddha. You've read his stuff. You think he's a cool doctor. He's got some decent methods that I can use to help me suffer less. That's the basis of turning to the Buddha, like turning to a doctor. But the second one is you've got to have confidence he's a decent doctor. The Buddha's a decent doctor, and that's up to you. Reading, thinking, analyzing. So you have confidence. One, you want his methods, and two, you can have confidence in him. This is reasonable. And turning to the Buddha has zero to do with asking him to forgive you, which is the way we think. Obviously, when I was a Catholic, I did indeed turn to God, and I did have to beg God to forgive me because he's the boss and I went against his will. That's what a sin is, and that's what you need to be forgiven to purify you. That's that. It's not here. Completely different. I'm not complaining about that one, but it's just not the same here. Of course Buddha would forgive you. He's a nice guy. But it's just not the issue. It's not the point. And now, in the second part, of this second step, reliance. You now, as they say, rely on suffering sentient beings, because now you want to cultivate compassion. The first one's for your sake. Now this is for the sake of others. You now think of those you have harmed. So I think of that baby I did have taken out of my body. And the poor little thing, at 12 weeks old, they didn't take it out properly, so I had to have a second one. I mean, the poor thing got all mangled, you know. They left bits in. I mean, that's terrible, isn't it? So I had to, you know, regret that killing. Because why? First, now it was for my own sake, now it's for the sake of that sentient being. But sure, that sentient being who ran like a magnet to my womb at the time of conception, it had the karma to come to my womb. And due to its past karma of having killed me, it created the cause to come to my womb and me kill it. You know, karma's mutual. There's no way that little sentient being could have been killed by me if it hadn't killed me, who knows, 47, 57 lives ago, whatever. Because karma's a natural law. So I have compassion for that sentient being whom I harmed, you know. And then compassion for the other sentient beings you've harmed in this life. All the ants and the fish and whoever you've killed, you know. Then the ones you've lied to, stolen from, blah, blah. You know, you think of the ones in this life. It's helpful to remember this life in particular things you've done today. And then you think, and whatever I've done like this since beginningless time to any sentient being, I regret it a lot. And you've got to say these words because you know what? Oh, no, I'm sorry, I forgot. This is now compassion. This is the first one. Regretting for your own sake. Now it's the sentient beings you've harmed. For compassion. It's almost like you're regretting for their sake now. I must purify myself for their sake. This is the second one, compassion. Now, the next bit of compassion, if we can be brave enough, have compassion for those who've harmed us. And this, of course, could be very difficult. So don't go there if you're not ready for it. You know, if you've been abused all your life by your father and you haven't sorted out your anger yet, and it's too soon to have compassion for him. So don't go there. Be reasonable with yourself. But if you can, if you are capable of having compassion for the person who's been mean to you, what's the reason? Pretty logical for the Buddha. Because they will suffer as a result of what they're doing to you. But you've got to have compassion for yourself first. You've got to really understand the first one first, which is that everything I say and do and think leaves seeds in my mind that ripen as my happiness or my suffering. Once you've got that down for yourself, it's easy peasy to have compassion for the wackos and the pedophiles and the murderers and the Donald Trumps and everybody else. We would have said George Bush 20 years ago, wouldn't we? Whoever you don't like. I mean, you might be a fan of George Bush, it's okay. I remember the Dalai Lama saying, he's a really nice man. I just maybe don't like his politics so much. That's what he said, it was very sweet. And he was a good man, George Bush. You can't say he wasn't. It's a question of liking his politics, that's all. I don't know about Mr. Trump, I can't work it out at all. Who knows? I don't know, he does his own hair, his butler said. I read in the New York Times. They interviewed his butler. He insists on doing his own hair. He even has a hairdresser on in his fancy place in Florida. He does his own hair. You've got to admit he's a fascinating man. And he's gripped all the papers. I mean, the New York Times and 2/3 of the stories on the front page are about Donald Trump. He's grabbing everybody. It's fascinating. I mean, it's mind-blowing. Fascinating. Who knows where it'll go? Anyway, whoever you dislike. So the third step is, and now it's called the antidote sometimes. This is where you take the medicine, basically. So in a practical sense, you know, if you regret in your daily life, you know. If you regret being lazy and you leave the dishes for 4 days and you go out in the kitchen stinky and the ants all around, you understand, let's say, and you go, instead of guilty, oh, I'm bad because I'm so lazy, whack, whack, beat, beat. No, you go, I regret, ridiculous, I regret my laziness, you know, because look at the mess. And now you go, you know, now, okay, forget the second step, compassion, nothing like that. But then you go, okay, what's the antidote to this? Well, the antidote is to do the dishes. Pretty simple, you just do the opposite. So if you're regretting killing, a really excellent antidote is go and save some lives. Go and save a few ants, save a few worms that would be otherwise killed by the fishing. That would be a powerful antidote. If you're regretting stealing, antidote is to give something. This is pretty obvious. This is good to do because it counteracts that habit. It's so sensible. That's the meaning of the antidote. It's obvious. Do the opposite. But a really powerful antidote, and this is where this is a Buddhist practice, and this is what looks more like religious, and we don't have to think about this. This third step is a particular practice, and if we've got time today, I said I'd lead you through the practice. I will try and do that. I will do that. Okay? We'll do that. Before we finish, we'll do that. So this third one is really the visualization of a particular Buddha and the recitation of his mantra. So this might be for people who, you know, haven't done this before. It might be a bit esoteric. But it's said to be, in all of our, by all the lamas and all of our traditions, is a really potent medicine. And we would take this one on board as and when we're ready, you know? But this third one, you could do the antidote business in your daily life, but if you don't know this practice and want to take these concepts home with you, it's practical, it's psychological. And the third one, you can even just do a bit of imagining white light pouring into you, purifying all the habits. It's just a simple little visualization. It's really simple, you know? You could do that. For this particular practice, we'll do it. We'll do it later. And the fourth one, in this, I like the four R's. This is regret, reliance, the remedy, and resolve. And this fourth one is where you resolve, you determine to change. This is the most powerful. So, let's say you badmouth your boyfriend all the time, you know? And you regret it in the beginning because you're sick of this habit. Then you have compassion for him. Then you do the visualization, the mantra, let's say. And then you'd go, and let's say it's a bad habit, and you can't say to yourself you'll never do it again. So don't lie to yourself, as Lama Zopa says. You give yourself a timeline. But this is really, you've got to be sincere. In this kind of practice, I call it like becoming your own friend. And I'm not trying to sound like a hippie here. It's really true, because we very rarely talk to ourselves in a constructive, appropriate way. We talk to ourselves in a brutal way. We criticize ourselves constantly. We put ourselves down. We feel sorry for ourselves. You know, we exaggerate everything. It's rarely a healthy, wholesome, reasonable conversation we have with ourselves. And then if we want to work out our stuff, we've got to tell somebody else about it and get them to tell us we're really a nice person, because we're not brave enough to tell ourselves. So we've got to be, this is like being your own therapist. It's such a powerful practice, so healthy, so wholesome, psychologically speaking, so practical, you know. So this fourth step, you know, let's say I will definitely say I will never kill again, I'll never lie, I'll never steal. You reiterate your vow. And indeed, that'll strengthen the habit to never kill. And you watch yourself like a hawk the next day so that you make sure you will not kill. But the bad mouthing your boyfriend is an old habit, let's say. So you don't lie. You say to yourself, well, you know what, it is an old habit, and I am sick of it, and I know it hurts him. You're sincere to yourself. So you give yourself a timeline. And I'm not joking. Like I said yesterday, you're doing this practice at the end of the day, and it's a nice way to end your day. I promise. You kind of clean up your act before you go to bed, you know. So you might say to yourself, well, I will not badmouth him until tomorrow, until at least for 10 hours. I'm not joking. You'll be asleep, so of course you'll keep it. You won't badmouth, you'll be asleep. So, but you've kept your commitment, and you give yourself courage. Then the next day you might go for 2 days, and before you know it, you might end up actually being able to say, I won't badmouth him again. Because you're developing a new habit. Because everything's habit. Habit. But what we tend to say to ourselves is, if we do the regret, it's more like guilt. Oh, I'm a bad person. I always beat him up. I'm such a bad person. Then we crave him to forgive us to get us off the hook. And then we say, oh, you know, I can't change. I'm so hopeless. I can't do this. And you just get caught up in misery, you know. We've got to kind of grow up. Regret it because I'm sick of the suffering. Have compassion. Do something to purify and make an intelligent decision. Because you're sick of suffering and you want to stop harming other people. And then you get courage from this. Because we know our minds are strong. We know once we decide to do something, we will do it. And that's what this last one is. You decide. So those things you can say, I will never do again, you do it every day. It's sort of like doing push-ups. You keep getting better at it. And don't think this is just wishful thinking. Because we don't give much power to our mind in the West. We even say, oh, it's only in the mind. This is shocking. The mind's everything. It starts from the mind. And once we know, we make a firm decision. You give yourself courage to do it again tomorrow. And it builds up. This is how karma works. It's habit, you know. It's such a tasty practice. And as Rinpoche says, we're insane not to do it every day. So it's sorting yourself out at the end of the day. Because most of us have such stressful lives, you know. Dramas and things and arguments and too much work and panics. And we've got to sort it out at the end of the day before we go to sleep and bring it into our dreams. And wake up even more neurotic the next day. And as Lama Yeshe says, you can go to bed with a happy mind now. Really and truly, it's such a great practice. And don't think of it as, oh, I've got to do my vow. You know, but many of us, we know the mantra, this call, the third step, the recitation of this mantra, Vajrasattva. Let's say we've taken the empowerment and we do it every day. And we go, oh yeah, I've done my Vajrasattva practice. Well, you haven't, and if you haven't done these four steps. Doing the Vajrasattva is only the third step. You've got to do all four. Because it's all part of the process of purification, you know. You can do it in a relaxed way. Sit in a chair, be comfy with your cup of tea. Relax. Don't be holy. Relax. You know? And it's a practical process you go through in your mind. You becoming a grown-up. You becoming your own best friend. You taking responsibility. And you get great courage from this because it's you changing yourself. So another component of all of this, you know, as we mentioned, karma ripens in four ways. First, as a type of rebirth. Second, as a tendency, a habit. Third, as an experience at the hands of others. Fourth, as an environmental result. So let's say... You know, okay, any action, good or bad, can have any or all of these results. And this is the point about vows and purification. This is why it's so intensely important. So that fisherman, for example, there he was, he got a human life. So at some point we can deduce this from the Buddhist teachings, this is just the Buddhist teachings, he must, as a result of killing, the major way it would have ripened would have been in the past lives in a suffering type of rebirth. That's the fully ripened result of killing. That karma eventually got exhausted, like the gas tank ran out. And at the end of some life, as a fish, as a dog, as an elephant, who knows what, a virtuous karmic seed would have been triggered that caused him to be programmed to run to a human mummy's womb and get born as this nice boy was Northern California, I think. So that human life was the fruit of one of his billions of karmic seeds that was lugging around with him, and with the good fortune it triggered and he got born as a human. So that karma has finished now, that particular killing karma has finished. But the tragedy was he hadn't purified all aspects of the killing. So the residual results of the main result, which is the lower realms, is he has the tendency to keep killing. He has the experience similar to the cause, which is to be killed or die young, and or the environmental result, which is to have an unhealthy body, that the environment poisons you instead of harms you, like the water, the peanuts, like you're living in an ugly environment where people are all killing each other. These are the environmental result of killing, the experience similar to the cause of killing, and the tendency to keep killing, the action similar to the cause, these three kinds of karma. These are the tragedy. Now look at the human realm. Wouldn't you agree? We've got a human birth, okay, we've got a human body, the fruit of enormous amount of virtue, even a crummy human body. We won the lottery, we got a human birth. This is not a joke, you know. For the Buddhists, there are trillions of sentient beings. There's not an atom of space you won't find sentient beings. Trillions. There's like 7 billion humans. It's like nothing. The number is so tiny in comparison with all. So, as one lama said, I love this, I tell you, I read this in a book years ago. When a male and a female human are having sex, billions of consciousnesses that have recently passed away, and clearly it can't be from the human realm, there aren't that many, billions of consciousnesses that have recently passed away are all hovering about trying to get in. Well, we got in. We won the lottery. I mean, I find this hilarious. It's like a completely hilarious picture, isn't it? I mean, it's hilarious. You've got to get nervous when you have sex now. All these billions of being hovering trying to get into your little womb. Woo! I think it's outrageous. I can't believe that. It's outrageous, you know. I love that analogy. Anyway, we got in, okay? I mean, just alone, the Buddha would say, having a human birth, we should be weeping in bliss every day. How hard we must have worked just to get it. Now, look at the human realm, please. And look at the nightmare of this human realm. So we look at the environmental. Look at the suffering environment of so many people. Poverty, war zones, terrorism, stinky, polluted, starving. Wouldn't you agree? That's environmental karma. And every one of negative actions brings its own environmental result. Having, you know, an ugly environment is, you know, I forget all the results, but it's all to do with negative actions of body and speech. Buddha says we create everything, you know. Living in a desert, for example, where there's nothing grows, that's the result of harsh speech. Living in a stinky, polluted, filthy, smelly, ugly environment, smelly and disgusting, is a result of sexual misconduct. Living in an environment where people are around you or dying young is the result of killing. Living in an environment where the food, the water, the air is polluted, result of killing. Having a body that's really unhealthy, the result of killing. All of this is a result of killing, sorry. People who get killed, look at the world. People who get killed or die young. I wouldn't be surprised if you did your research, we never do this research, that more humans who get the human body, who won the lottery and got in to the human womb, die before they're even born. That's called a miscarriage or an abortion. I would say the number must be huge. They got a human birth, but due to past killing, their karma ran out even before they got born. Look at the babies who die, the 1-year-olds, the 6-year-olds, the 10-year-olds, the 17-year-olds, often with, as we quote, no medical cause. Well, the Buddha said their karmic petrol tank ran out due to killing karma. Then you've got those who have the tendency to kill. Well, I would suggest most humans kill something. I would suggest most religions. I was taught as a Catholic. I love my Catholic upbringing. I was taught as a Catholic that God made other creatures for humans' benefit. And many Christians who are very devoted, it's an honour to kill and eat God's creatures. I'm not criticising, I'm just talking. So it is interesting, the tendency in humans to kill. Most humans kill something. Ants, roaches, other humans, fish, you name it, deer, kangaroos, anything. Most humans kill something. It's rare to find a human who has a wish not to kill any living being. Think of it. Well, this is the tragedy. So because all those humans haven't, for example, those who haven't regretted killing, that's what causes you to get killed. By regretting killing, you purify that one. Most who continue to kill, that's because they have never vowed not to kill again, obviously. So this is my other friend, I was quote, little boy, his son, 3 years old, she's taking the lice out of his head, and he's in tears of compassion. Mommy, mommy, don't hurt them, it's their home, leave them alone. He was doing everything for her to stop killing the lice in his head. She wasn't killing, she was trying to take him out. And he's 40-something now, and he's never killed a living being. So we can deduce logically from using this view that he had vowed never to kill again. What a miracle. What an amazing being. He's getting ahead of the game, you know. The tragedy. We've got a human life, but look. Chipping it down the toilet. So this is the function of keep living in vows and purification. If you vow never to kill again, guess what? You wake up next life with never the thought to kill again. This is the way the Buddha says karma is. It's not just some hippy-chippy idea. Because they're four separate tracks. Each got their own trip, you know. You can have the karma to keep killing, but might never get killed. You can have the karma to kill, but you might die young. There are four different tracks, and they're all the fruits of trillions of these different karmic seeds, you know. So to live in vows of never killing, never lying, never stealing, and to purify, I mean, you couldn't wish for more, have a better life. You can live a happy life. There's no, you know, and you don't have to do anything else more you do on top of that is a bonus. But with doing other things like being mindful every day, watching your breath, but not keeping your vows, you're going 5 steps up and 27 steps back, wasting your life. Well, get my point. Are we communicating here? I'm not asking you to believe me. I know I shout and yell and kind of sound like I'm forcing you. I'm not trying to do that. You can be a Lama Yeshe. I don't care if you're a Buddhist. You can be Mickey Mouse. You know, you don't care, you know. So regretting, according to Jhapa Gyatso, regretting killing directly, specifically purifies you getting killed. So let's say in your daily life, this is very potent. Let's say you're at work and you get bad mouth, because this is where it happens. It's the family and it's work, isn't it? People accuse you of doing something you didn't do, and it's like a nightmare. You want to go mad. You go running home, you cry. You can't believe they're accusing you of this thing that you just didn't do. And you're frantic to get these people to change their mind, aren't you? We nearly go mad in this kind of scenario. Well, guess what? Sit down on your cushion, be brave, and realize this being bad, accused of something I didn't do, is the direct result of my doing that in the past to these people. So I regret this from the depths of my heart. Why? Because regret is because I can't stand the suffering. And you know you can't. It's happening right in front of you. If you do this every day, and I've seen this in my own life, do not be surprised that that's what causes them to change, because you purify the karma. So like I'm saying about the fleas and things, you know? Many people have told me this. If you have incredible regret for the past, like, let's say it's cockroaches in your kitchen. So what are the cockroaches doing? They're living in your spoon drawer, dropping their little things into your spoon drawer, aren't they? You know, we think they're disgusting, filthy, putrid creatures. Isn't it? Yeah. So disturbing your peace. So don't just, you know, remember that they're your cockroaches. You've got personal karma with those sentient beings. I'm not joking here. They're not in my house, they're in your house. They're your cockroaches. Hi, cockroaches. Welcome home. Then you check with them, and then you regret whatever you must have done to mess up their house in past, to invade their home, whoever they were, and, you know, do all the thing over it. You deeply regret whatever harm you must have done to these cockroaches, deeply from your heart. Because why? Because I don't want the suffering. And you don't, you know it, right there. Then don't be surprised, I'll go. I've heard this so many times, I tell you, from people. Because karma, the Buddha, is the cause of everything. So if they're there because of your past action, and you purify it, don't be surprised they go. Because it's now the dynamic has changed. Yeah. Don't be surprised that people stop criticizing you. Regret's very powerful, right here and now. Of course, in general, it's all about regretting because you can't stand the future suffering. And the next life you'll wake up with no killing and no harming and no bad-mouthing. It'll all be perfect. Wonderful. But it could even start to happen now. Don't be surprised. And the other thing is, it stops you from all that self-pity and panic and fear and victim mentality. It makes us take responsibility. Not guilt, but wow, this is the fruit of my past action. There it is, staring me in my face. You grow up when you say that. Rather than, poor me, how dare you do it, I'm innocent. And you're frantic like a vampire to get them to change, you know. You can't force the people to change, but you can help take responsibility and you calm down. You get stronger. It's amazing. Very powerful. The second one, you by having compassion for others. They say this purifies environmental result. Third one, doing the third practice, the antidote, this purifies the lower realms, suffering, the main one. And the fourth is obvious. If you vow every day never to badmouth, well, guess what? You won't have a tendency to badmouth. So you will stop doing it. This is the most powerful, most obvious. So this is changing yourself, the whole dynamic of changing yourself and purifying the imprints in the mind. It's changing yourself radically. And as Lama Yeshe says, you can go to bed with a happy mind. It's a great way to end the day, you know. So any questions before we do it? Questions?
This is about karma, and this is aside from the things that you can do while you're enjoying death. Apart from that, we sort of, even though we know better, we think of our actions affecting our next life in a linear fashion, as if whatever sentient being we are next, that's who we're benefiting. But we were taught that that's not how karma ripens. It could be from any of our past lives at all.
Oh, yes, it's highly complex. I mean, yeah, exactly, of course, absolutely. The things that happened to us in this life might be from a thousand lives ago. Absolutely, it's not
so
simple like that.
It's kind of a bummer to be trying really hard to benefit, like, I think of myself as the caretaker of my subtle consciousness.
Good.
And then whoever gets it next. And I'm doing the best I can to make sure that it's in good shape for the next person and
perfect.
Has some closer
yes.
enlightenment.
Absolutely.
But what if it just something from my, I was Genghis Khan and oh boy, you know, they end up being, it just sort of like bummer, you know?
Okay, now what's the question? Get it down to a question, it might help.
What's a good way to think, is there a way to think about it just to make it not seem so futile?
Oh, I don't think it's futile. What are you talking about, futile? It's like yours. What's futile? I'm really lost here. What's futile?
Nothing. It's just that there's so many karmic actions from so many
darling.
Lives.
Okay, it's a huge number that gets me. That's right, exactly. So, okay. So this is why. Okay. So let's say you decide, you recognize this, and you've got countless lives, and there's trillions of karmic seeds, and blah, 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 all the rest, as you say. So then you decide to live in your life, you live in vows. Like we said, you vow not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, even this level. Then you do the purification. And every day you're living a good life, you're watching yourself like body, speech, and mind. You're really being all these things. And you're training. You connect a bit with the Buddha, you do a few practices. And then you're ready. So first you're ready for death. And now this is the time why death is so important. This is the thing. It's like, it feels like a lottery. It feels like pot-like. It feels like futile, as you said. But this is why death is unbelievably important time, which we're going to talk about this weekend, obviously. So if you have led a life of morality and you've trained yourself, so that's prevalent for you, and therefore your mind's more peaceful and you're accepting death and you die slowly, not dropping dead in your soup. That's just a drag, you know. It's better to die slowly. Better to die gradually. Better to not be in advance. Be warned, you know, so you know you're preparing for it. And then the other one is to be, the ideal is to be surrounded by people who your beloveds, who know your practices, who know how to take care of you, who know the death process. That's what the point of this book is, like education. Really to, and you totally trust these people. You're listening to the Dharma 24 hours a day while you're getting sicker and older and more senile, not even senile, and you're learning to recognize. And the other one is, you've trained your mind all your life, because you know that you're in charge of this process. There's not a superior being up there who's running the shots and going to punish you or reward you. You realize that you are the one who's in charge. And this is the way it all sounds so hilarious. But it also means that you're in charge of deciding what kind of life you want. So there's only really two options for the Buddhists. A good human birth, or what they call a pure land, and we'll discuss that this weekend. But let's say you've decided you want a human birth. You see, the thing is, I think even if we have this view of karma, we still have a very strong feeling still, like we had when I was a Catholic, that someone will see, even if I've got a guru, you know, I've got Lama Zopa as my teacher and I see him as the Buddha, and there's also this vague feeling, well, Rinpoche must be seeing I'm a good girl, and I'm sure he'll give me a good human birth when I die. It's like we want to be rewarded, like we're good girls, you know, but we realize we're in charge. And I mean by this, this is all part of the honey, this is part of the answer. If I want to, let's say I want to go on a vacation in a year's time, we know perfectly well the first thing is to say, I want to go to Australia next year for a vacation. Wouldn't you accept? You've got to first have the thought. You don't just say, oh, may I go to Australia, may I go to Australia. Please somebody get me to Australia, I hope I'll make a good girl. You know, you don't say like that, I want to go to Australia, you'll say. And then what do? You've got to buy the ticket, pack the time, get the money, put it in the bank, organise it, pack your bags. And then you're ready, packed to go, aren't you? And you'll go exactly where you planned. Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that? Honey, that's how karma is. So you've got to decide, would you like another human body? If we take the view of karma.
But I don't think of that as me. Like I said, I think
excuse
I'm
me,
just
shush.
My subtle...
Just shush. 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 Would you like to, if your consciousness does continue like Buddha says, I don't care what you label it, would you like it to go to another decent human body?
Oh, yes.
A nice mummy's womb. Would you like to meet the Buddha's teachings again?
Oh, yes.
And you'd like to have a decent life? So
absolutely.
That means, okay, so first you've got to say, I'd like to be born as a human being next life. Mm. Then you've got to say, what kind of human being, sweet, what's your name?
Christine,
well, you say to yourself, well, Christine, what kind of human body? Well, you know, boy or girl, you can decide. Then you can go, well, I want a decent mother. I want them to be in a decent country with decent politics and a bit of money in the bank so I'm getting a good education and that they're peaceful and kind and won't rape me or harm me and nice siblings and nice aunties and uncles. You think like this, like the vacation. What kind of room do you want? You just don't say, oh, I'll go to Australia. Where? I don't know. You decide. Melbourne, Sydney, Bendigo, which hotel, what kind of room, 4-star, 2-star. You make plans, right? This is so shocking to our mind, but you do exactly the same here. So you go, okay, would I like to have lots of money in the next life so I can have plenty of time to practice my Dharma? Well, you better be generous, babe, and definitely keep your no-stealing vow. Then you check, well, do I want to live a long life? Well, you've got to stop killing. Do I want really healthy life with no bad environment and no lousy foods? I want to better not kill. You've got to act like this is the practical result. So the more you focus on it, I want a human body, then you will do the things that will give you the human body and the conditions and the money and the Dharma and the people. So that by the time you're dying, you're really relaxed. You're ready, packed to go. And then you'll be peaceful. They'll be doing all the prayers around you and the karmic, and that'll trigger the best karmic seed just like you planned. And before you know it, you'll go to the bardo, and then your new mummy hops into bed with her daddy, and you go there and off you go. All your planning works out, babe. So yes, all your Genghis Khan karma and your rapist karma and your ego and your killing karma and your lion karma, you kept that nicely underneath because you haven't purified it all yet until you realize emptiness. But you got it nice under control, honey, because the other stuff's running the show. It is like this. It sounds hilarious to us to be so practical about it because we just think it's mysterious and no one knows. And like you said, futile. If it's a natural law, honey, it can't be futile. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
If it's a natural law.
It's just very, very slow. You know, sometimes
you feel like... Excuse me, you're not... What's slow? You could be dead tomorrow. It's not slow, honey. What are you talking about? What's slow?
I guess the overwhelm is the thing.
They always talk about everything. Christine! And... Shush! What bit of what I said is overwhelming? What bit of what I said is overwhelming? Which bit? Which bit of what I said is slow?
Not what you said.
Thank
so
you.
I'll
then
drop
keep
it.
Keep yourself calm, relax, calm down, and it's take
like
it
red.
One set at a time, Christine, and feel like you're in charge. I mean, even just for me, working on this Book of Lamas over the last 5 years, I edited it. It's only really, sort of almost I can say that maybe I'm realizing I just might die, you know? Because it's sort of finally hitting home. And then realizing much more clearly that I really am in charge of it. This is what Buddha's saying, but we find this impossible to believe. Because we're so addicted to believing it's all too impossible. The Western one is like a scientific truth. Nobody knows, we say, as if it's a truth. And then you have faith, or you have faith in God. I'm not complaining. That's much better. But we're used to thinking it's chaos. We're used to thinking there's no law. We're used to thinking it's random. That's the problem. So to actually think this one, have confidence in it, just keep focused and have confidence. It's not easy.
Thank you
very
much, Venerable.
Okay. Someone else? Yeah.
Hi, thank you. I have... stop smoking, and I tell people the way I stopped smoking was that every day I don't smoke.
Well done, yes.
So the way I see what you're saying is that every day we should be saying the same thing.
Yes.
We don't. So take
don't
it to
kill.
The nth yeah. degree of I don't smoke because I choose not to smoke, not because I took a pill or a patch or something, but I just tell myself every day, you're not smoking today, and it's been 10 years. But I guess... That's what you're saying, is that we've got to do that for everything and say every day.
But wait a minute, why can't you say, why you don't want to say, I will never smoke? Why don't you want to say that? I'm just asking you, I'm curious. Why wouldn't you want to say, I will never smoke again? And then every day you say, I will never smoke again. Every day you say, I will never smoke again. Every day you say, I will never smoke again. Why don't you want to say that?
I guess because I might die tomorrow, so... I say today I'm not going to smoke, and then tomorrow...
No, you didn't. You said today I don't smoke.
Right.
I'm just curious why you don't smoke. Say I will never smoke again. I'm curious. That's what I'm asking you. I'm not saying you should.
I have no answer.
What?
I could.
Can you see a benefit in that?
Yes.
I mean, when you say, you don't say... I mean, what is it that caused you to walk out the door? It's the thought, I will walk out the door. You've got to state it, don't you? I will walk out the door.
Right.
I will have breakfast. I will go to bed. You don't say, I am in bed. You've got to say, I will go to bed. And then you can say, I'm in bed.
Right.
So there's something about, I will. This is the meaning.
Well, I guess that is what I'm telling myself. I will not smoke.
Okay, well, you didn't say that, though.
Yeah.
So now you are. Okay,
so,
fantastic.
Yeah. So...
We so have that's to take about everything. Yes, precisely.
Degree of everything.
Yes, everything. That's
so,
right.
So my question is, and this might be a silly question, but if you're at the... I just experienced my father's death, and
yes.
it was a very peaceful
yes.
act.
Yes, wonderful.
And
wonderful.
We helped him along, and
wonderful.
It was beautiful.
Wonderful.
And it changed my life. It's the reason
wow.
I'm here.
Amazing. Yeah.
And I wonder, though, what if you're at that hour of death, and my two sons start arguing. Is that going to affect
yes,
my
would.
Death?
Definitely it would. So you've got to keep them out of the room.
But I'm dying.
I know. See, this is why when we do it in the weekend, we'll talk. The ideals... Well, we're going to do the practice. We'll talk about this the weekend, okay?
Okay.
You're going to come, will you?
Okay.
I want
yes,
to do this.
I am.
It's only 15 minutes. We might be a bit late today. If you have to leave early, please leave. Any other questions? And I'll lead you through the practice, though. We'll do it quick, okay? Just give you the idea. Shall we do it?
Yes.
Okay. So close your eyes, be comfy, don't lean in the chair, okay? Let me just briefly tell you about how the position for meditating, which is the ideal scenario all the meditators have found to be most conducive to help your mind focus, you know? So the ideal, well, here we are sitting in chairs, most of us, but if we're not, full lotus position, all the great meditators have found that's most conducive for the energies, all the subtler energies in the body to flow nicely. And of course, it keeps you very upright. You don't topple over when you meditate for a long time. Well, most of us can't do that, and here we are, most of us in chairs. So the thing is, have your back straight, your feet firmly on the ground, okay? And don't lean into the chair. It keeps you nice and alert. You hold your own body up, all right? And your hands relax in your lap with a meditation mudra, or on your knees, I don't mind. But your body very straight. They all say you think of your spine like an arrow. And the coccyx is the head of the arrow, pointing directly into the earth, very straight. I like to think of all of our skeleton like hanging on a hanger. It's ramrod straight, isn't it? It must be. And all the soft bits relaxed, hanging on the bones, completely relaxed. All your muscles, your abdomen, your shoulders, all the muscles flopping, but your body upright. That's the ideal scenario. Your head tilted forward, best. Slightly chin tucked in. Your lips apart, and the tip of the tongue behind your top teeth. This is the ideal. The meditators have found that having the tip of the tongue behind the top teeth prevents you from dribbling while you're meditating. It's most convenient. Practical. And your eyes should look down. All the best meditators say, the ones who meditate lots, you know, day and night and everything, especially for the daytime, when the light comes in, that really helps you keep your mind sharp. But most of us get so distracted, so maybe have your eyes closed. But your eyeballs beneath your eyelids should be looking down, as if you're looking along your nose. So settle into that position. Your back straight, upright, relaxed. Chin tucked in, lips apart, tip of the tongue behind the top teeth, eyes looking down. Okay, now settle into this very unselfconsciously. Because your body doesn't meditate. It's just... your mind does, okay? So we're going to do a little thinking. This is like a little visualizing thinking meditation, okay? Be very relaxed about it and do according to what you can do with all this information. So the first one we're going to just regret. We're going to think of some things we've done to harm others. Today, let's say, bad-mouthing, criticizing our boss, being mean to the husband, shouting at the kids, uncontrolled, you know, then we feel bad. Maybe we've killed creatures, you know, lied, bad-mouthed, harmed, just today. Maybe a little bit, a few things, think of them. Especially involving other sentient beings. And then think, just think simply, you know what, speak to yourself, you know. You can say your own name to yourself. You know what, I regret this from the depths of my heart because, you know what, I'm sick of suffering. I don't want this tendency to continue. I don't want to have this type of thing happen to me. I don't want the future results, and I don't want this unhappy feeling. I'm sick of suffering. So from my heart, I regret this for my sake. I'm sick of suffering. And then we can think of a few things even in this life. Sometimes we carry such heavy burdens, such pain and guilt and grief about things we've done in the past, you know. So maybe if you feel like, you know, you want to, the abortion, the killing of creatures, the things we've done to harm others, the cheating on partners, the grief we've caused in others by our bad behaviour, unkindness, whatever. Any actions of our body and speech, and in particular we've done in this life, and we remember that, and think. You know what? I regret having done this out of my ignorance, because I don't want the damage it's doing to myself. I don't want this habit. I don't want this to happen to me, and I don't want this burden inside me. I can't stand the suffering. I'm sick of this suffering. I regret it from the depths of my heart. You know, it could be stealing, it could be being mean to other people, cheating on people, lying to people, being brutal to people, abusing people, talking about them behind their backs, killing, things we've done with our body and speech that harm others. But we're regretting it here because we don't want the harm to ourselves, because we are sick of this suffering. And then we can think, if it makes sense to you, think, and anything I've ever done since beginningless time, the seeds of which I'm carrying with me, I regret these from the depths of my heart, because I do not want the suffering, because I'm sick of suffering. I am sick of suffering. From the depths of my heart, I regret these for my sake. So think, whom can I turn to? Whom can I rely upon to give me method, to give me medicine, to give me tools, to give me techniques that I can use to help purify myself? So here, of course, we turn to the Buddha. But if you're not a Buddhist, maybe you like Jesus. I don't mind, you know. Maybe you just think of white light and then whatever you like. Maybe there's no one you can think of relying on. It doesn't matter if you can't. But if you have, you know, the feeling of the Buddha, you visualize above your head the Buddha. Just think of him in this particular form, this radiant energy of enlightenment manifesting in this white light body, you know, sitting on a lotus. If you know the picture, don't worry. If you do, then fine. If not, don't think too much. Doesn't matter. Just think of enlightened energy, blissful, perfect, powerful, enlightened energy. Whatever you like, visualize above your head. And just think, you know, so delighted to rely upon, in, you know, the Buddha, my doctor, my mentor, who has methods that I can use. How marvelous, how fortunate. The second part here, we rely now on sentient beings. We're now going to have compassion. That means those we've harmed. You know, the babies we aborted, the fish we killed, the ants we killed, the cockroaches, you know. Even the dogs, our pussies and the doggies whom we had put down at the vet. We killed them, basically. But we meant well. It's okay. But we're not sure what type of rebirth they got because we didn't have the wisdom. And all the sentient beings, even the ones, you know, I don't remember that I've harmed, I have compassion for their suffering. I must have some karmic history with these sentient beings, and I deeply regret for their sake. And I must purify now for their sake. I'm going to meet these sentient beings again, so I want to meet them in the best way and be of benefit to them. Compassion for them. We know what it's like to suffer. So we know how they feel.
And now if we can, you know, those who harmed us, and we have all been harmed sometimes so badly, the pain of it sometimes is unbearable, how people have harmed us in this life, ones we can remember. You know, parents who abused us, other people who've abused us, harmed us, you know, accusers of things we didn't do, lied to us, stole from us. Terrible things. We've all had things done to us by other sentient beings. So if we can, have compassion for them. Due to past karma, due to our history with these sentient beings, they've harmed us because we harmed them, and they will suffer for the harm they've done to me. So for this reason, have compassion for them, because they will also receive the consequences of this, because this is the way karma is. So if we can have compassion for them, because they, like all of us, harming, being harmed, and always thinking everybody else is to blame, like living in this nightmare of no sense of responsibility. So such a basis for compassion for them, if you can. I must purify for their sake. All sentient beings, so much suffering. If I don't help them, who will? So now the third step is take the medicine. So we visualize it. We know this one. Don't worry. If we do, that's good. If not, then just imagine like nectar pouring in, like a hose of energy, hose of nectar coming from the heart of this enlightened being above us, arcing around, entering our crown, and like powerful hose of this nectar filling us completely. And first of all, imagining purifying, driving out all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginning this time to sentient beings with our bodies. Forcing it all out like filthy liquid, disappearing into space through the lower parts of our body. Not one atom left. Full of this powerful nectar. Driving out all the negativity of the body. Like filthy liquid. As you recite the mantra 3 times. If you know it, fine, join in. If not, just focus on the visualization. Really imagining it, really wanting it, really feeling this is what's happening.
Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sujo Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha Ha Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sujokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memtayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe.
Imagine, full of this nectar, not one atom left of all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since the beginning of this time with our bodies, gone completely, disappeared into space. How marvelous. And now we imagine this blissful Buddha Vajrasattva, the nectar pouring out from his heart, arcing around, entering our crown, and filling us completely like a hose of energy, so strong. But this time, forcing up to the surface of our body all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginning this time to sentient beings with our speech. Like this filthy liquid coming upwards, driven up, like as Lama Yeshe says, when you turn on a tap in the sink, all the junk in the glass comes to the surface, doesn't it? Just like that. Imagine pouring out all the imprints of all the harm of our speech like filthy liquid from the top part of our body, driven upwards by this powerful, delicious nectar.
Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sushokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarvasiddhi Mevrayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachakata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Mevrayatsa Sawa Kama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Not one atom left. Full of this blissful nectar. All the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginning of time with our speech to any sentient being. Gone. Disappeared. How fantastic. And now we visualize this time beams of light. And I don't know if beams of light can arc around, but let's imagine they do. From the heart of the Buddha arcing around, you know, entering our crown, filling us, and instantaneously, like Lama Yeshe says, just as soon as you turn on a light in the room, instantaneously the darkness is dispelled. So here the same. Instantaneously, all the imprints in our mind of these delusions, the ego grasping, the attachment, the anger, the fears, the dramas that have impelled us to do things with our body and speech to harm others, these are the source of all our suffering and the harm we've done. So instantaneously, we imagine, this is all annihilated. Right there. Imagine. How amazing. Full of this radiant light. Having purified all the delusions, all the obstacles to our liberation, all the gross delusions. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayata Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayata Sawa Kama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayata Sawa Kama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. So now we imagine one more level of purification. This is they say this is the purifying, even the subtlest imprints, like even the smell of the delusions. They call the obstacles to omniscience. And this time we again just visualize this light coming and purifying even these subtlest imprints. I remember one person one time saying, it's like, now we've removed the garlic from the jar, now we have to remove even the smell. Even the subtlest imprints. This light coming again, purifying even the subtlest, and then manifesting, of course, and then our perfect enlightenment. Just imagine this. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakta Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Kama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anorakta Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Meprayatsa Sawa Kama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chachagata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahung Pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupadaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakta Mebawa Sarvasiddhi Memprayata Sawakama Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Chajagata Vajramami Mutsa Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe. So now we can imagine this Buddha, Bodhisattva. You know, if we have a spiritual teacher, the oneness with their mind, they very happily just dissolve into light and absorb through our crown and merge completely with the energy of our body, our speech, and our mind. So we think the energy of the Guru, the energy of the Buddha, merge with mind, becoming oneness. Just dissolve into you and then just space out. Feel as big as the universe. No thoughts for a couple of minutes. Just space out. Blissful, radiant, clear, perfect. Okay, now I forgot the fourth step, so we have to suddenly revert. Never mind. We imagine we're perfect and blissful now, but we have to make a decision, the fourth step, which is the most important, which is the vow not to do again. So if we've taken vows, like no killing, no lying, no stealing, we really know we can keep them, we reiterate, I will never kill again. I will never lie again. I will never steal again. Our vows, you know. But other things like bad-mouthing your boyfriend, being lazy, eating too much, I mean, all things that harm others as well as your own other habits, which we didn't really go into. These you make decisions about. You know, you make some decisions. So you do some, say to your own mind what you're going to plan to do. And this is even including the things that just harm you, like your own rubbish habits, you know, feeling sorry for yourself, being depressed, being angry, you know, getting jealous. Just a few little things that you know your old rubbish habits that have confidence. They're not set in stone. They don't define you. So make a few little decisions to yourself, even your own main things, you know. Make some decisions. Give yourself a timeline, a few hours, a day, a week, whatever you think you can do, with confidence, you know, and reasonableness. Don't lie to yourself. Make some decisions about what you plan not to do. Decisions. And then finish, just being delighted. Delighted with, you know, engaging with ourselves, making some choices, having some confidence, having some compassion for ourselves and others. Knowing there's not one millimeter of anything in our mind that we can't change. There's not one fraction of our being that's set in stone. This is the miracle, you know. This is what's marvelous, which gives us so much courage to see our potential, to develop to perfection all our goodness, and to rid the mind utterly, eventually, of all the rubbish. This is Buddha's essential thing, you know, this unique approach. We have all the potential to be a Buddha. It is slow, but once you're on track, it doesn't matter if you have to travel 20,000 miles. If you've got a map, you can be comfortable. You can enjoy the process. So yes, it might be slow, but if you've got a map, then you know where you're going. If you don't have a map and you even have to go 1 mile, you'll be lost for hours. And that's where the panic is, not knowing what you're doing, not having a map, not having confidence. So one step at a time. Follow the map. If you have a map, if you haven't chosen yet, that's fine. It's up to you to find your map. One step at a time. And so now we dedicate what we've done tonight.
this last, you know, whatever long time, as many moments as there have been, as many thoughts we've had, as many thoughts as many seeds. So all these seeds have gone in, all these thoughts have gone in. May we nourish these seeds from this moment forward with our effort, with our confidence, with our self-respect. So we never give up working on ourselves so we can be of benefit to others. Kewadi nyu du dag lama sangge drug your ne drowa chi kyang malupa jei sala ge pa shog jang chob sem chog rin po che ma ke pa nam ke gyu chig ke pa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong du pa va shog.
Excuse me, may I read some dedications?
Yes, read the dedications.
I apologize for not doing dedications last night. Two of the sponsors are sponsoring yesterday and today, Neil Oldham and Kim Lillick, and they have the same dedications. Neil's is, may we all enjoy the blessings of hearing this beautiful Dharma in this lifetime. And Kim's, thank you, Venerable Robina, for coming back to us. May your spirit sustain your body. And today we have an extra sponsor, Karen Edwards. May we work together harmoniously to bring the light of Dharma through Kadampa Center projects of Family Camp and Light of the Path Retreat.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Okie dokie. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
See you all somewhere. Thank you.